Sat by computer with a virtual universe to achieve certain goals or defeat a deadly enemy. The design process of these games is becoming increasingly sophisticated in order to provide the player with the ultimate gaming experience.
Making video games is a growing global business worth over $27 billion. I'm Miriam O'Reilly, and in this week's Masterpiece on the BBC World Service, I'm going to find out how to make a video game. Ernest W. Adams is an author and video games design consultant. He believes video games are an art form in their own right and shouldn't be dismissed as low culture, appealing only to teenagers.
A good video game is one that draws a person into the game's world, lets them feel as if they've gone away to a wonderful place and there they can do an amazing thing, something that they couldn't really do in their own real lives. Good video games take us out of ourselves, take us away to far-off exciting places, and let us do exciting things.
How do you design different games for different markets? Do you have to take into account those cultural differences?
Yes, it's very important to do that because different things mean things in different countries. For example, the color black is the color of death in the West, and in China, for example, white is the color of death. So you have to understand things like that. And you also have to understand what the population likes in terms of how it chooses to enjoy itself. People's sense of humor varies differently from place to place. So things that might seem screamingly funny in Britain are often considered just rather quirky and odd in the United States. So when translating the content of a game from one place to another, even within the same language, sometimes you have to adjust for the sense of humor or the cultural sensibilities of the people in different countries.
It is a huge market, a huge global market worth tens of billions of dollars, and it is continuing to grow. What are the upcoming markets?
I think that the ones to watch in the near future are both India and China. Both India and China have large, upwardly mobile populations, and they have well-educated, highly qualified engineers who can build games for their own cultures. So those are the two ones in the near future. And then I think the Arab-speaking world. I think there's a large Middle Eastern market that is anxious to buy video games if there were video games that suited their cultural sensibilities, but they will probably need to make them for themselves, and they will naturally draw on their own culture and history. Of course, Islam has this wonderful medieval culture and history going back to Saladin that provides all kinds of exciting material to use that we in the West have never learned or tried to exploit.
Looks like we got company.
Well, the team at one of Europe's top video game design companies, Kuju, in Sheffield in the north of England, are going to talk me through creating a video game from scratch.
My name is Tony Kavanagh, and I'm the studio manager.
Let's start at the beginning. Mm-hmm. How is a video game originated? What's the first step?
Well, the first step, obviously, is contact with the client. Typically, a publisher will look at a number of developers. Certain developers have expertise and will only produce racing games. There are studios that specialize in racing games. There are studios that will specialize in war games, simulations.
What sort of budget are we talking about?
Depending on the scope, the number of formats that they want, and the formats being PlayStation 2, Xbox or PC, typically today you'd be looking at between $3 and $5 million. They usually look for us to quote across the whole spectrum, so they'll want their products on the leading platforms, which are PlayStation 2, Xbox and Nintendo.
Looks like I was lucky. He didn't even make it to the ground.
I'd better lose those soldiers first.
Gaming also moves in trends. We've just gone through a trend of very successful war movies, Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers from HBO. That spawned a number of very, very, very successful realistic war video games. Racing is always a very, very popular genre. Sports, football, American sports, baseball, all have their following, all have their brand leaders.
How many video games are spawned from films?
If you take a publisher typically like Electronic Arts, they have the exclusive rights to the Harry Potter series, they have the Lord of the Rings series, and they have the James Bond series. These are huge, big franchises that transcend over to video games very well.
So if you have a successful film, then you'll have a successful video game, you're saying?
Providing the same quality and the same attention to detail has been put into the video game as the successful movie, then yes, it usually works. The very successful computer games or video games can recoup their costs on day one ship. So pre-orders, the amount that is sold in the first week, and they're into profit. And if you get a really successful title that will carry on selling for 6 months, which is quite unusual in our industry, then obviously you can see kind of profits will be made ultimately all along.
My name is Phil Marley. I'm a games designer with Kujo Entertainment. I take over when the company has already talked to the client and everybody at least has sort of an idea of the game they want. And then I'll sit down and plan out the very basics of what the game is going to be if there's a plot involved, which there isn't in all games. It wouldn't be, for example, we're doing a football game. But if there is a plot, then what the plot's going to be, the scope of the game, is it going to be played by one player or lots of players? And then once we've got that together, I'll start talking to our technical people to see whether any of that's possible. And if it is possible, whether it's possible within the budget and within the timescale.
Simon Pashley, you're the technical director here. We're sitting in your computer workshop. It's not what I expected. It's very quiet.
It's always this quiet, really, because a lot of the development staff, which include programmers, artists, designers, they often know exactly what they're doing. So they virtually just sit at their workstations with their headphones on, just working away.
So, as a technical director, the skeleton of an idea for a video game comes to you. What do you do then?
There's two typical disciplines in game development. There's art and there's programming. Art is what you see on the screen. If you were to stop the game and look at it, that's the art aspect of it. Some of the movement comes from that as well, say the animation of a person, the animation of the flaps going up and down on an aircraft, the undercarriage coming out, the animation of, say, a door opening would all come from the artist. How the actual things move around in the world and what you do in the world is typically controlled by the programmer. So if you push forwards on the joystick, you would expect a standing person to lean forward, you would expect them to start walking, you would expect them to continue walking until you let go of the joystick, at which point they would stop, come to a complete rest and stand upright. All of those control aspects come from the programmer.
Where do you get your ideas from for a plot?
I think a little bit from everywhere. I mean, one of the fun parts of my job is I have to sort of go away, do a bit of research on lots of different subject areas. I mean, just in my time with Kujo, I've sort of looked at everything from steam trains to volcanoes in Hawaii to, you know, football management issues. So it's a great job in terms of you get to sort of dabble in lots of different things.
Is the sky the limit for an idea, or are there some things that are unbelievable that you have to dismiss?
Well, there's always some sort of healthy back and forth that goes on between the designers and the people in charge of the technical side of things. The designers will always want the biggest game possible and a full sort of orchestral score. And then we have to kind of rein that back and say, well, okay, you know, we can't do that, but we can do this instead. And eventually we arrive at sort of a really good sweet spot of, you know, a really good experience for the gamer, and we can do it in the time and the budget.
When do you start thinking about your audience in this process and what they want?
That happens right at the start. I mean, usually the client has a pretty good idea that sometimes I'll say, you know, we think we've identified an audience. We want to sell this to people who are into skateboarding and, you know, sort of new metal. You know, we want to get that sort of atmosphere, you know, quite edgy. And so when we go away and start thinking about it, we'll immediately say, okay, so, you know, we don't want cutesy characters. You know, we're looking at tattoos and we're looking at, you know, skate punk sort of image. Thank you. us saying, we believe that there's a lot of people out there who like trains. And, you know, there aren't any train simulation games, a lot of games where you fly planes, but nothing with trains. And we think if we did something like this, people would buy it. And so we had to go away and, you know, talk to some of these people and find out what they wanted. And we found out that, you know, Microsoft were right. There really were a lot of these people. Nobody was catering for them. And we had to go in and sort of understand them and understand what they wanted. And then we made a game called Microsoft Train Simulator, which turned out to be very, very popular.
How much do you have to know about trains when you're designing a video game or, you know, aeroplanes? What's the extent of the research that you do?
It depends on the project. If when we were doing a game called Eagle One some years ago that was set in Hawaii, I sort of had to go out and buy maps of Hawaii and, you know where the volcanoes were and where the bridges were and stuff. That's sort of quite a lower level of detail. If we're doing something like Train Simulator, not just the designers, but most of the people working on the project really had to almost learn how to drive these things and learn, you know, the signals and the rules of the railroad and things, because it was such a detailed, intense simulation, because that's what people wanted. We try and keep the player immersed. We try and keep the player's suspension of disbelief going. So if you're playing Train Simulator, you want to really believe you're driving the Flying Scotsman. If you're playing a football game, you know, you really want to feel like you're at Wembley. And as soon as something happens that either is wrong or just doesn't quite feel right, you know, if the crowd isn't sort of chanting and if the referee doesn't sort of act like a referee, people will notice, and immediately suddenly they're back in the living room and they realise they're only playing a video game, and that's what's the fun. But a lot of games are more story-led, and they have a strong plot, and if they do, then we have to write that, and we have to make it engrossing, and it has to be a solid story with, you know, a beginning and a middle and an end and character development, because these days people do expect that.
A good video games designer is one who has a great deal of imagination and a story to tell, but also has a clear sense of what his audience wants. So a designer is always sort of balancing between the desire to be an artist, to express himself, but also the desire to entertain, to let other people entertain themselves. That's part of the difference between interactive and passive entertainment. A video game designer is creating an experience for another person to interact with and to enjoy. And always putting yourself in the shoes of your player is a critical ability for a good game designer.
There's a certain expectation now, again, with the last generation of titles that have come along, where people expect the world to be totally and utterly like the real world. There was a landmark title last year called Half-Life 2, which came out. And what that introduced for game players was the total concept of real environments, where previously what you would have gone into is a room and there would have been a desk with a cup on top of the desk, and you could have bumped into the desk and nothing would have happened. Whereas now what people expect is to be able to pick the cup up, throw it around the room, smash it, you know, go and move the desk itself, block the door to stop the bad guys coming in behind them. So everybody's expected to do that very same thing. And that comes back to the real world, everybody expecting it to be like the real world. And it's up to us as developers to make sure that that's right, and it looks right, and it's contemporary.
What about the characters in your video games? Do they have to be universal to reflect different nationalities?
A good example of that would be the soccer titles that we produced recently. A previous expectation would have been to, say, a white skin tone and then darker skin tones and brown skin tones, and that would have been the expectation. Whereas now people expect them to look exactly like David Beckham with his latest hairstyle, with exactly the right skin tone. If he's been on holiday for 2 weeks, they expect him to have the right skin tone. And that scales up. The club football title that we really did recently had, for example, all of the UK Premier Division teams, which are 92 football squads, each with 32 players. We had to do each one of those as specific heads, which the art team had to actually create. And then for the rest of the teams, there's, say, 5 UK divisions, 5 in France, 5 in Germany, 5 in Italy, 5 in Spain, you know, Africa, Asia, all of those things. I mean, there were tens of thousands of people, and they all have to look the same. Because you can imagine somebody in the UK or in France, you know, choosing their particular club to play in the game that they've been a fan of for 10, 12 years. They go into their team and, you know, their favourite player is in there, but he doesn't look like their favourite player. They'd be mightily upset and they expect him to look exactly like their favourite player. We have to cater for everybody's expectations and what they're actually going to look like.
Let's check the replay.
My name's Nick Phillips. I'm the lead artist at Kuju Sheffield.
Once the technical director creates the game model, what do you do with that?
We have to dress that in whichever style is appropriate for the game that, that we're working on at the time. You know, photorealistic, where we're actually using, you know, photographic images which are applied to the models, or, you know, photographic realistic characters which are then animated, using a form of animation called motion capture, which is basically using live actors who are filmed creating the moves that were required for a certain character. If it's a football game, they're like shooting, tackling, or if it's the goalkeeper saving their ball that's heading for their goal.
Do you ever use anything as simple as a photograph to recreate a scene or an image?
Yes, for photorealistic games. When we were doing the train simulation game, teams were sent really around the world to photograph the engines, the rolling stock, and the lines that we were, you know, recreating. We would video all the routes that we wanted to do, take photographs of all the major buildings on the route, the train stations, and any landmarks along that route.
Otherwise, you'd have someone calling you up and
exactly.
saying, yeah, I live just outside Bangalore, and you haven't got it right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
What's the most difficult image to recreate?
I think it's probably going to be the human face, because, I mean, that's what most people see every single day. They look in the mirror. Like in the football game here, where we are, you know, creating so many different faces for each specific player, it's getting... Yeah, the cheekbones, right. But and then the animation as well, which is extremely difficult, getting all the blinks and little ticks and things that people do which you don't normally notice. You just take it as read. But if they're not there, you do notice that they're not there.
So how do you recreate those facial images for the video screen?
Again, it's 3D model, and we apply a bone structure behind the 3D mesh of the face, and then these are then animated to create the mouth movements, the blinking eyes, and any twitches or movements of the skin on the face to make it look real.
Would you call yourself an artist? You're the artistic director, but it's not
yes,
one would imagine an artist's work would be.
Well, there's still a lot of traditional art skills, you know, required. There's a lot of you know, paper art concepting the start of a project. There's also storyboarding required, and still having to sculpt the polygons in the 3D programs on the computer.
So Phil Marley, senior games designer, the artists hope that they've finished with the video game. They hope it's nearly ready for the client. But is it? Is there another stage still?
Once we reach that stage, we'll start handing it off to our quality assurance department, who exhaustively test the game. And that happens in here.
Hi, I'm Carrie Hobson. So here we've got the latest title that we're testing in QA at the moment, and this is getting ready for submission. So what we'll do is we'll get the build and we'll play through it, which is what Mark's doing at the moment. We'll play through the level and just make sure that everything works as it should do. And the other important thing to do, as far as the test department is concerned, is to check everything that you shouldn't be doing doesn't break the game. So that if people go off the map or decide to investigate down this corridor or whatever, that they're not going to get anything untoward happening in the game that's going to lose their data or get lost or whatever that might be detrimental to their actual gameplay. So that everybody that plays the game will be happy with the end result, basically.
Some people would say you have the best job. All you do all day is play video games.
Some people would say that, but there are certain downsides to the job as well as just playing games. You're not playing them. You're actually testing them for problems, so it's not as fun as it might appear to be on the surface. And it's not just playing it when you feel like it, it's playing it for 8 hours every day. So, yeah, the novelty can wear off when you've been doing it for a while.
Phil, the video game has been tested for bugs and for faults, and it's pure enjoyment value, and it's finished and it's ready for the client. What's it feel like when you sign that video game off and it leaves this building?
Well, there's a real sense of ownership because, I mean, this is something that's usually taken 2 years out of 20, 30, even 60 people's lives.
Is making video games an art form in itself?
I think if you look at how young an industry we are, I think we're just taking the first steps towards that. I mean, books have been around forever, you know, film compared to video game has been around for a long time. So I think with some of the groundbreaking stuff that's coming out of some of the studios now, we're just starting to get to the point whereby it can be considered an art form.
Books and films, though, change people's lives. They have depth to them. Many people would say that video games aren't. They're just pure thrill, pure entertainment.
But I think if you look at some of the stuff that we're doing in the industry these days, like the massive multiplayer online role-playing games, you know, if you talk to some of the people who play them a lot, who've even met their partners and their wives on those games, artists now in the industry are starting to have exhibitions. They're all learning from each other. So in some ways, it's almost like the early days of film, whereby people are just starting to realise what can be achieved.
Why do you think they have such appeal?
Well, partly because they enable you to participate. They actually stimulate the mind rather than just sort of feeding you with images. So you're doing something. Sometimes you're doing it in concert with others. And that is an exciting thing to do, to be part of a story rather than to simply watch a story. They can, in fact, be a lot deeper than you give them credit for. They can contain rich stories. They can be about rich characters. Now, it's time-consuming to make a game that does that, and we're not very good at it yet.
They do play with the emotions, though, don't they?
I think, in fact, it's a good thing. I think that having video games that actually touch people deeply is a worthwhile goal for the industry to try to reach. Video games have the capacity to be much more emotionally rich than they are, and I think as an art form they will continue to improve. They require a great deal of talent and skill to create. They are, in fact, capable of possessing themes, literary themes that have messages about life and death and love and violence and war and all the things that are around us. I think the purpose of art is to touch people, and I believe that video games are capable of doing it.
Ernest W. Adams, thank you very much.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
My thanks to Phil Marley and the team at Kuju for telling Masterpiece on the BBC World Service how to make a video game. I'm Miriam O'Reilly. Thanks for joining me.
Game over. Program over. Many thanks. Masterpiece was produced by Maggie Eyre.
The headline.